This is Live Science for the week of September 20th, 2025. I'm Alex Sagan, and I'm ready to guide us through, well, an immense stack of the most compelling and maybe consequential scientific findings from the past few days.
And I'm Sam Fleming, here to help synthesize what is a truly staggering mix of information. We're really going from the deep past, like geological formation, right up to immediate high-stakes public health decisions.
Yeah.
Our mission today is basically to cut through all that noise and give you, the listener, the definitive deep dive into what these discoveries actually mean.
We are truly bouncing around today. I mean, the formation of ancient life, the deepest corners of space, navigating complex public policy debates, even the ethical boundaries of human development in the lab.
It's huge.
We've got everything from measuring the explosive recoil of merging black holes to the contentious reconstitution of a major CDC committee.
It really is a huge week. And what I find fascinating is how often findings on completely different timescales seem to, you know, inform one another. Like the gravitational dynamics that set Pluto's orbit hundreds of millions of years ago. You could see that as a kind of template for stability.
Okay.
And that's a template we're trying to establish today in things like, say, vaccine policy, consistency, predictability. It's interesting.
Let's jump in then.
Okay.
Let's unpack this. Starting with maybe one of the biggest gravitational puzzles right here in our own backyard. Pluto, that dwarf planet, it's still an enigma, isn't it? With that truly peculiar orbit.
Pluto is definitely the rebel out there.
No.
When you look at the eight major planets, right, they orbit on a relatively flat, consistent plane, pretty orderly.
Right.
Pluto, though, its path is highly elliptical. So it gets much closer and then much farther from the sun. And it's extremely tilted compared to everyone else.
You're not playing by the rules.
Not at all. Its behavior is much more like other icy objects way out in the Kuiper Belt. Things like Makemake or Eris.
So the main explanation for this, the consensus one, is that it was basically captured by its big neighbor, Neptune.
Yeah, that's the standard story. Early in the solar system's history, Neptune migrated outwards, and as it moved, its gravity swept Pluto up into a resonance.
A resonance, like a gravitational lock.
Exactly. A stable pocket carved out by Neptune's movement. And that lock is the critical detail here. Pluto and Neptune are in this stable 3-to-2 orbital resonance.
Meaning?
For every two times Pluto finishes its long 248-year orbit, Neptune completes exactly three orbits.
Okay.
Now here's the kicker. Pluto actually spends 20 years of its orbit inside Neptune's path.
Which sounds incredibly dangerous.
You'd think so. But this resonance ensures they can never collide. Because of that 3-to-2 timing, Pluto is always in a safe, predictable position relative to Neptune whenever it crosses that path. It's a really a remarkable example of long-term stability through complexity.
But okay, here's where the latest research gets really interesting, right? It sort of refines that older model. There's another major oddity. When Pluto reaches perihelion, that's its closest point to the sun, it is always high above the plane of the other planets. It doesn't bob above and below like you might expect.
Right. And the old assumption was just, well, that's the Neptune resonance doing its thing.
But it's more complicated.
Exactly. The new analysis shows that this unique fixed inclination, always high above the plane at its closest approach, isn't maintained just by Neptune. It actually requires the cumulative gravitational pull of Jupiter and Uranus, too.
Ah, the other giants weighing in.
They're working together in concert to dictate this other peculiar characteristic of Pluto's orbit, keeping it elevated, stopping gravitational jostling from throwing it into chaos. It tells us the whole architecture of the outer solar system, how those ice giants migrated. We're still figuring out the details.
Speaking of figuring things out, mapping things. Let's move from Pluto's strange path to mapping the entire universe. We turn to fast radio bursts, FRBs. They're apparently finally providing a solution to a huge cosmological head-scratcher, the missing baryon problem.
The missing baryon problem. Yeah, this is fundamental. Baryons are just ordinary matter. Protons, neutrons, the stuff that makes you, me, stars, planets.
The normal stuff.
The normal stuff. And based on our best model of the universe, the Lambda CDM model, which includes dark matter and dark energy scientists expect a certain amount of this baryonic matter to exist.
Okay.
But when we actually look around, count up all the stars and gas and galaxies, we can only account for about half of what should be there.
Half is missing. So if it's not in galaxies, where is it?
Well, the hypothesis has always been that it's hiding in what's called the warm-hot intergalactic medium, or WIM.
Whim?
Yeah, think of incredibly diffuse, faint wisps of really hot plasma spread super thinly between galaxies. One source put it perfectly. Finding it is like trying to see fog in the dark.
Because it's just too faint and spread out.
Exactly. It's not dense enough to emit much light or form stars, so it's been functionally invisible until now, maybe?
And this is where FRBs come in, the flashlight in the fog.
Precisely. These things are brief, like milliseconds long, but immensely energetic radio pulses. They discharge more energy in that instant than our sun does all year.
Wow.
And they are uniquely suited to finding this invisible matter. They travel vast distances, billions of light years, and crucially, as they pass through baryonic matter, the protons and electrons in that WIM, they get slightly slowed down or dispersed.
Dispersed. How does that work?
The lower frequency radio waves in the pulse interact more strongly with the plasma electrons than the higher frequency waves do, so the low frequencies arrive at Earth just a fraction of a second later than the high frequencies.
So this signal gets smeared out slightly.
Exactly. And importantly, dark matter doesn't interact electromagnetically, so it has absolutely no effect on the FRBs. They just pass right through it.
So by measuring that smearing, that dispersion.
Measuring the dispersion, yeah. The difference in arrival time across the frequencies, scientists can calculate precisely how much baryonic matter that FRB signal passed through on its journey to us.
And has this been done? Does it work?
It's been robustly applied now, using hundreds of FRBs where we know roughly where they came from. And the results strongly confirm it. The missing baryons are indeed in the WIM, hiding in plain sight, basically. It reinforces the Lambda CDM model's original estimates.
That's a huge confirmation for cosmology. But the origins of the FRBs themselves are still a bit mysterious, right?
Very much so. And there's new insight there, too. One recently localized FRB wasn't traced to a young, active, star-forming galaxy like we usually expect.
No, where was it?
It came from the outer edge of a dead galaxy, one that had stopped creating new stars a long, long time ago.
Okay, that is weird, because the leading theory involves young, energetic objects.
Right. The traditional theory is that FRBs come primarily from young magnetars. These are highly magnetized neutron stars, often found in active star-forming regions. Finding one in an ancient, quiet galaxy that throws a wrench in the works.
So what does it imply?
It suggests that FRBs might be produced more often than we thought, and maybe by different, possibly older stellar processes, not just magnetars. This potentially vastly increases the number of FRB sources out there.
So what are the bigger implications of successfully using FRBs for this kind of cosmic map making?
Oh, the implications are huge. It goes way beyond just finding the missing matter. If we can locate thousands of these FRBs accurately,
Which seems more possible now if they come from more places.
exactly, then astronomers can statistically map the spatial distribution of this ordinary matter across the entire cosmic web, how it clumps, where the filaments are.
And why does that distribution matter so much?
Because the presence of baryons, even diffuse ones, profoundly impacts gravity. It influences how supermassive black holes grow and regulate themselves, where stars decide to form, how galaxies evolve over billions of years. This is really the next frontier for understanding cosmic structure.
Let's stick with those gravitational giants then. Black hole dynamics. Starting with the first one we ever got a picture of, M87. We've got evidence now its behavior is way more dynamic than we might have thought.
Yeah, M87, that supermassive black hole 55 million light years away. The Event Horizon Telescope collaboration compared images from 2017, 2018, and 2021, specifically looking at polarized light.
Polarized light. That
Yeah.
tells you about magnetic fields, right?
Exactly. The polarization pattern is essentially a map of the magnetic field lines. It traces the state of the matter swirling into the black hole and getting shot out in those jets. And what they saw was, well, dramatic.
What happened?
The polarization pattern literally flipped direction. The magnetic fields seemed to be spiraling one way in 2017. They sort of stabilized in 2018 and then completely reversed direction by 2021.
Flipped. That sounds unstable.
It implies immense instability, yeah, right near the event horizon in the accretion flow and the base of the jet. Now, this could be the structure of the magnetic field itself changing, or it could be something called Faraday rotation. That's where the magnetic fields and the charged particles in the plasma actually rotate the plane of polarization as the light travels towards us. The key thing is, the total intensity images, the overall brightness distribution, stayed pretty consistent.
So it wasn't just the whole thing getting brighter or dimmer.
Right. The fact that the polarization changed so dramatically while the overall look stayed similar means the underlying structure of the field, or the plasma itself, is evolving really rapidly. M87 is definitely not some static beast. It's a highly dynamic environment that needs almost constant watching.
Okay, next up, a literal kick for a black hole, the natal kick. For the first time, scientists measured the recoil velocity of a new black hole, one just formed from a merger. This was from signal GW190412.
Yeah, this was a fascinating merger because it was highly imbalanced. You had one black hole about 30 times the mass of the sun merging with a much smaller partner, only about 8.4 times the sun's mass.
Okay, big difference.
Huge difference. And when two black holes merge, they radiate gravitational waves. But if the merger is uneven, like this one, the waves aren't radiated equally in all directions. There's an asymmetry.
And like a rocket nozzle.
Precisely. That asymmetry gives the resulting newly formed black hole a powerful kick in the opposite direction. Conservation of momentum.
So how powerful was the kick in this case?
Because of that large mass difference, the resulting baby black hole got shot through space at over 31 miles per second.
Per second? That's, what is that?
That translates to a blistering 111,600 miles per hour.
111,000 miles per hour. Is that fast enough to escape something?
Absolutely. It's faster than the escape velocity of its likely birthplace, which was probably a dense globular star cluster.
So it gets launched completely out of its own home.
Right out of the cluster. And this measurement is crucial. Because if the new black hole escapes its cluster, it can't merge with other black holes in that cluster anymore. That limits its potential growth path towards becoming a supermassive black hole later on. So understanding the speed and direction of these kicks is essential for tracking how black holes form and evolve throughout the universe. The more imbalanced the merger, the bigger the kick, and the higher the chance the new black hole just becomes a lonely rogue wandering through intergalactic space.
Sticking with explosive ideas, new theoretical calculations suggest we might actually observe a primordial black hole explosion much sooner than we thought, like via Hawking radiation.
Yeah, this is pretty wild. The odds are now being placed at something like 90% within the next decade.
A decade. That's way down from the old estimate, wasn't it? Like once every 100,000 years or something.
Exactly. A huge jump in probability. But, and this is a big, but it relies on a very specific, highly speculative assumption.
Okay, what's the catch?
The assumption is that the primordial black hole, these are hypothetical black holes formed in the very early universe, is temporarily stabilized by possessing a small, positive, dark electric charge.
Dark electric charge. Okay, folks, what is that?
So the theoretical framework here is called dark QED, or dark quantum electrodynamics. Think of it as an extension of our familiar electromagnetism light, electric charge, into the dark sector.
The realm of dark matter and dark energy.
Right. The idea is that maybe certain hypothetical particles, perhaps remnants from the early universe, carry this dark charge and interact via dark photons. And this dark charge could theoretically counteract the black hole's evaporation via Hawking radiation just for a little while.
So it slows down the evaporation, letting it survive longer.
Exactly. It gives it a temporary stability, allowing it to survive until today before finally erupting in a final flash of Hawking radiation.
And if we actually observe that eruption?
Oh, it would be absolutely revolutionary. If this model is right and we see the explosion, which would likely appear as a very specific kind of high-energy gamma-ray burst.
What would we learn?
It wouldn't just confirm Hawking radiation itself, which has never been directly observed, and it wouldn't just confirm the existence of primordial black holes, the specific energy signature of that final burst, the particles it throws off. It could potentially give scientists a complete catalog of every subatomic particle that exists.
Including dark matter particles.
Potentially, yes. If dark matter interacts via this dark charge, its signature could be in that explosion. And the amazing thing is, our current gamma-ray telescopes are already sensitive enough to detect the predicted signs. We just need to know what to look for and, well, get lucky.
Okay, before we leave the cosmos entirely, let's bring it closer to home. Because our own star, the Sun, is apparently sending us a pretty serious warning about space weather.
Yeah, NASA is warning that we should expect more extreme space weather for decades to come. And this directly contradicts some earlier theories that suggested the Sun was heading into a prolonged quiet period. A deep solar minimum.
Like the Maunder minimum back in the 17th century. That idea is out now.
It looks like it. Observations show pretty clearly that basically every metric of solar activity, the solar wind speed, the sun's magnetic field strength, and especially the number of sunspots, has been trending upwards since around 2008.
And the current sunspot cycle?
The current cycle, cycle 25, has already produced the highest number of sunspots we've seen in over 20 years. The sun is definitely waking up, not going to sleep.
So what does that mean practically? For us, down here, especially with our increasing dependence on space technology.
It means we face a much greater and more sustained risk from space weather events. Increased solar activity leads to more powerful X-class solar flares and, more concerningly, more frequent and intense coronal mass ejections, or CMEs.
Right, the CMEs are the big blobs of plasma the sun throws out.
Exactly. And when a powerful CME hits Earth's magnetic field, it can induce huge electrical currents in long conductors on the ground.
Like power lines.
Like power grids. This poses a major threat, potentially causing widespread, long-lasting blackouts. Think the Quebec event in 1989, but potentially worse or more frequent.
And it affects things in space, too.
Oh, absolutely. CMEs disrupt the ionosphere, which severely degrades GPS signals and high-frequency radio communications, and they pose direct risks to all Earth-orbiting satellites, especially those in low Earth orbit, which face increased atmospheric drag that can de-orbit them faster, and also internal charging risks that can fry their electronics.
So the takeaway is we need to prepare for a more active sun for the foreseeable future.
Definitely. It requires significant hardening of our infrastructure, both on the ground and in space. The era of assuming a quiet sun seems to be over.
Okay, let's make a big transition now. From the vastness of space right down to the immediate urgency of public health policy here on Earth. Specifically, let's talk about the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP.
Right, and the context here is impossible to ignore. It's become quite political. The committee has been newly reconstituted under the leadership of the current HHS Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Who, it has to be said, previously campaigned against childhood vaccines.
Correct. So that change in administration and the new makeup of the ACIP committee immediately injected a lot of uncertainty into what have usually been pretty standard vaccine guidance updates.
And they just held a crucial meeting to establish the new recommendations.
Yes. And one of the most high-profile votes concerned the combined MMRV shot. That's the one that covers measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella chickenpox all in one injection.
What was the decision there?
The committee voted 8-3 against recommending the combined MMRV shot for children before the age of 4.
Against it. So what are they recommending for those young kids?
They're recommending that children under 4 receive the MMR shot and the varicella shot as two separate injections, often called MMR plus V.
Okay, why the change? What was the rationale?
The decision stems from a known risk difference. Although it's statistically small, it is measurable. The combined MMRV shot carries a slightly higher risk of febrile seizures compared to giving the two vaccines separately.
Febrile seizures, those are the short seizures caused by a high fever, right? Generally not harmful long-term.
That's correct. They're frightening for parents, but typically don't cause lasting damage. The data indicates about one additional febrile seizure occurs for every 2,300 to 2,600 doses of the combined MMRV shot given to toddlers aged 12 to 15 months, compared to giving MMR and varicella separately.
One extra case per roughly 2,500 doses. That's the core safety calculation driving this.
That seems to be the primary rationale presented, yes, weighing that slightly elevated seizure risk.
So what are the broader implications of this decision, of essentially removing the combined option for that age group?
Well, firstly, it does remove a choice for caregivers. Some parents prefer the combined shot to minimize the number of injections their child receives at one visit.
Although wasn't the separate shot option already more popular?
It was, yes. It's worth noting that about 85% of parents were already opting for the separate MMR plus V injections before this decision. So for most people, this doesn't change current practice.
But there's a bigger impact related to federal programs.
Right. This is where it gets more significant. Initially, the committee seemed like they wanted to avoid changing coverage under the Federal Vaccines for Children program, the VFC program.
That's the one providing free vaccines to uninsured and underinsured kids.
Exactly. But then, on Friday, they actually reopened the vote and decided to align the VFC coverage with their new recommendation. Meaning the combined MMRV shot is now no longer covered by the VFC program for children under 4 years old. This directly impacts access for some vulnerable populations who relied on VFC to get that specific vaccine formulation covered. It really highlights the rapidly shifting regulatory landscape.
And this landscape is now so fractured, apparently, that the American Academy of Pediatrics, the AAP, took the step of issuing its own recommended immunization schedule.
That's right. And they explicitly stated they would not endorse the new CDC recommendations, citing the leadership changes at HHS and CDC. This kind of public divergence between major health organizations like the AAP and the CDC is pretty significant. It signals a real break in what used to be a fairly solid public health consensus.
Hmm. And this environment, this uncertainty, surely informs the discussion around the COVID-19 vaccine eligibility for the upcoming 2025-2026 season as well.
Absolutely. The ACIP did ultimately recommend that everyone over 6 months old is eligible for the updated COVID shot without needing a prescription or copay, as long as they consult with a healthcare provider, and that includes pharmacists now.
Okay. Eligibility for everyone over 6 months, that sounds like a broad endorsement on the surface. But I hear there was some important nuance in the language used, especially for people under 65.
There was, yes. For those under 65 without specific high-risk conditions, the committee did not give what you might call a full-throated endorsement. Instead, they used the specific language of shared clinical decision-making.
Shared clinical decision-making. What does that signal typically?
Historically, ACIP uses that phrasing when the committee is less confident that the benefits clearly outweigh the potential risks for every single person in that broad group. It essentially shifts more of the onus onto the individual patient and their doctor or pharmacist to weigh the personal risks and benefits based on individual health factors, exposure risk, that sort of thing.
But despite that more nuanced phrasing for the under 65s, the vaccine will remain on the official CDC schedule.
Yes, and that's key. Because it remains on the schedule under the Affordable Care Act, it must continue to be covered at no cost by private insurance plans for everyone over 6 months old. Access should remain broad.
And providers are being encouraged to discuss risk factors.
Strongly encouraged, yes. To discuss the really extensive list of factors that put people at higher risk for severe outcomes from COVID-19. And this list is very broad, you know. It includes things like asthma, heart conditions, type 1 and 2 diabetes, obesity, being currently or recently pregnant, various disabilities like Down syndrome, even conditions like ADHD have been linked to higher risk.
So for anyone with those factors, the benefit calculation is likely much clearer.
Much clearer, yes. The shared decision-making language applies more to generally healthy individuals under 65.
And just like with the MMRV, we saw states moving ahead of, or maybe diverging from, the federal guidance here too.
We did. We saw regional alliances like the West Coast Health Alliance, which includes California, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, and the Northeast Public Health Collaborative covering 10 states plus New York City releasing their own guidelines pretty early on.
And were they generally aligned with the eventual CDC recommendation?
Often, they align more closely with guidelines from the AAP and the American Academy of Family Physicians, the AAFP. They didn't necessarily wait for the final federal guidance. And in some cases, like for healthy young children between 6 months and 2 years, and for pregnant people, they often seem to favor vaccination more strongly than the eventual ACIP shared decision-making language might suggest.
It really shows regional public health bodies stepping in to maybe fill what they perceive as a vacuum of trust or certainty at the federal level right now.
It certainly seems that way, a very fragmented landscape.
Okay, let's move to environmental health now, which often ties directly into the health of the most vulnerable, like pregnant people. We have some concerning lab findings about air pollution and its effect on the placenta.
Yeah, this was a fascinating study. They used something called a placenta perfusion system. Basically, it's an artificial setup using real placentas donated after birth that mimics both the maternal and fetal circulation.
So they can watch the effects of pollutants in real time.
Exactly, in highly controlled conditions. They expose these placentas to fine particulate matter, PM2.5, the kind you find in urban air pollution.
And what did they find happening to the placenta after exposure?
The results were pretty immediate and, frankly, quite troubling. Even brief exposure, we're talking as little as 30 minutes, induced noticeable structural and immunological changes.
Structurally.
The collagen structure within the placenta became visibly disrupted. That indicates physical damage to the integrity of that crucial tissue barrier between mother and fetus.
And immunologically, what happened to the immune cells?
There are specialized immune cells in the placenta called Hofbauer cells. Normally, they maintain an anti-inflammatory protective state. But after PM2.5 exposure, these cells shifted into a fully inflammatory state.
And that's bad.
That inflammatory state is strongly associated with adverse pregnancy outcomes, particularly preeclampsia, that dangerous condition involving high blood pressure during pregnancy.
And there was another indicator after about an hour, something about HCG levels.
Yes. After an hour of exposure, they noted increased production of human chorionic gonadotropin, or HCG. Now, HCG is essential early in pregnancy, but high or rising levels later on, like in the second trimester, are also linked to a higher risk of preeclampsia and fetal growth restriction.
Okay, but the study used a high concentration of PM2.5, right? Like simulating a pollution spike.
That's true. The concentration used in the lab might be higher than average daily exposure. However, the findings strongly suggest that prolonged lower-level exposure throughout a full-term pregnancy could cause accumulated clinically relevant harm. That damage to the placental barrier, the chronic inflammation, it could build up over time.
So the implication is, maybe we could target that inflammation therapeutically.
That might be a future possibility, yes. Trying to subdue that inflammation could be a therapeutic target. But really, the most effective intervention is obvious. Reduce PM2.5 exposure itself, especially for pregnant individuals. Clean air is critical for healthy pregnancies. That's clearly the main takeaway. Now let's pivot to something quite different, but equally complex, the ethics of consciousness. This isn't just philosophy anymore. It's becoming a science policy issue, mainly because of how fast these tiny brain organoids are advancing.
Brain organoids. These are the miniature brain-like structures grown from stem cells in a lab.
Exactly. And they're getting complex much faster than anyone really anticipated. They're now being developed with their own blood vessels, which helps them grow larger and more complex. Scientists can even fuse different types of organoids together into assembloids.
Assembloids?
Yeah, representing functional communication between multiple brain regions, like, say, the cortex and the thalamus. The complexity is skyrocketing.
And this is raising ethical alarms.
Urgently, scientists involved in this research are arguing that regulations need to be revisited immediately because these organoids might soon achieve, or perhaps already have achieved, some basic level of sensation, maybe even a capacity for pain.
Sensation or pain in a lab-grown tissue?
Wow, it's a profound threshold. Experts argue that if organoids gain consciousness or even just sentience, they become morally relevant entities.
Morally relevant entities.
Yeah.
What does that mean in practical terms for research?
It means they should probably receive the same kind of regulatory oversight and ethical consideration that we currently give to lab animals like mice and rats.
So rules about minimizing suffering, justifying use.
Precisely. It would likely require evidence of sentience, the capacity for subjective experience, suffering, perception. Right now, the research rules are pretty lenient because organoids are assumed to be non-sentient tissue. If that changes, researchers would likely be forced to adopt the 3 R's of animal research: replacement, reduction, and refinement, basically minimizing their use and any potential suffering.
The scientific community is trying to get ahead of this then, before the technology crosses a line that forces the issue.
That's the idea, to have the ethical framework in place before we potentially create something with subjective experience in a petri dish.
This technological leap, this blurring line, connects directly to the broader societal anxiety around the AI singularity debate, doesn't it? We saw that reflected in a recent Live Science Reader poll.
Absolutely. That poll showed a really deep split and a high level of concern among readers. 46% said they believe AI development must be stopped entirely due to the potential existential risks.
Nearly half want to stop it.
And another 30% said they want at least a significant delay, a pause to implement safeguards and work on ethical alignment. So you're looking at 3/4 of respondents being highly concerned and demanding immediate regulatory action or a halt.
But there was also this strong undercurrent in the comments, wasn't there? A feeling that maybe it's already too late.
Yes, exactly. Many readers commented things like, "There's no shoving that genie back in the bottle." It reflects the sense that the technology is developing so rapidly, and once it's released into the world, real control is almost impossible to regain. We're forced to adapt to its consequences rather than proactively manage its arrival.
And this difficulty in managing complex, rapidly evolving systems, it mirrors some of the discussion around how online social networks seem to amplify dysfunctional thinking, right?
Definitely. We see cognitive biases that we all have, things like confirmation bias, where we favor information that confirms what we already believe.
Or motivated cognition, where we twist facts to fit our desired conclusions.
Right. Those biases get absolutely turbocharged by online networks. Algorithms feed us more of what we already like, creating echo chambers. And this isn't just online chatter. It leads to real-world consequences. Think about the vandalism and arson directed at 5G cell towers, driven by completely unfounded conspiracy theories that spread like wildfire online.
It seems like when deceptive messages are tailored to exploit those cognitive biases, just presenting factual, truthful messages often isn't enough to compete.
It creates this constant arms race, doesn't it, between those trying to spread propaganda or disinformation and those trying to convey accurate information. And the result is often increased social discord, polarization, and a real lack of consensus, even on things with strong scientific backing, like vaccine efficacy or the reality of climate change.
Okay, we've been jumping between timescales, milliseconds for FRBs, decades for solar cycles, maybe the near future for AI ethics. Let's bridge that now by talking about a resource that literally came into being 830 million years ago, but is incredibly crucial for our technological future today. We're talking about the birth of a major rare earth metal deposit.
Yeah, this is about a massive, newly discovered source of niobium found in central Australia. And this is a pretty significant find, both geopolitically and technologically.
Niobium. Remind us why that specific metal is so critical.
Niobium is essential for a few key high-tech applications. It's crucial for making superconducting magnets, the kind used in MRI scanners and particle accelerators.
Okay.
It's also vital for powerful gas turbines, like in jet engines, and for creating specialized high-strength steel alloys used in aerospace, defense, construction. Really important stuff.
And the issue has been supply.
The issue has been concentration of supply. Right now, something like 90% of the entire global supply of niobium comes from basically one mine complex in Brazil called Araxá.
90% from one place. That's a huge vulnerability.
Massive. Any disruption to that single source, political instability, natural disaster, anything, would immediately ripple through global technology and defense supply chains. It's a major strategic bottleneck.
So finding a new large source like this in Australia is primarily about diversifying that supply chain.
That's a huge driver, yes. Security of supply. The geological specifics of this discovery are really interesting, too.
What do they find? Two deposits.
Two main deposits, named Luni and Prien. Together, they're estimated to hold around 200 million metric tons of niobium-bearing ore. And the geological origin story is fascinating. The rocks that contain the niobium are called carbonatites. They're relatively rare igneous rocks. And these particular ones formed about 830 million years ago, right when the ancient supercontinent Rodinia was starting to tear itself apart.
Rodinia. Okay, going way back. What does the breakup of a supercontinent have to do with rare earth metals like niobium?
Well, when a supercontinent like Rodinia starts rifting, the Earth's crust gets stretched incredibly thin along those rift zones. It creates pathways.
Pathways for what?
Pathways for magma from deep within the Earth's mantle to surge up towards the surface. And magma originating from that deep can often carry concentrations of rare elements like niobium. The analysis of these Australian carbonatites showed a clear mantle fingerprint confirming this deep earth origin.
So understanding how this deposit formed gives geologists clues for finding others.
Exactly. It helps create a kind of predictive checklist. Look for ancient rift zones from supercontinent breakups. Look for signs of deep mantle magma intrusion. It could help pinpoint other potential niobium hotspots around the world.
Okay, moving from deep earth geology to deep human history. Researchers have apparently rewritten the timeline for mummification, identifying the world's oldest known human mummies. How old are we talking?
Up to 10,000 years old, which significantly predates the more famous mummification practices from places like Chile, the Chinchorro mummies, and of course, ancient Egypt.
10,000 years. Wow. Where were these found?
These remains were discovered in dozens of ancient graves across Southeast Asia and also in China. Researchers were looking closely at skeletons that were buried in a very specific way, heavily hyperflexed.
Hyperflexed, like curled up tightly.
Extremely tightly, contorted into these compact, crouched positions. And when they examined the bones closely, they found consistent evidence of low-intensity heating and also persistent discoloration from soot.
Soot, suggesting smoke.
Precisely. This combination of hyperflexion, gentle heating, and soot is really consistent with a known cultural practice. Ritual smoke drying of the body after death.
And this is a practice still seen today.
Remarkably, yes. Similar smoke drying preservation techniques are still observed among the Dani and Pumo people in Papua, Indonesia. Finding archaeological evidence for it this far back and spread across such a wide region is immense.
What does this discovery tell us about ancient human migrations or culture?
Well, it suggests a really profound cultural continuity across these pre-farming communities in Asia, and it also strongly supports what's called the two-layer model of early migration into Southeast Asia.
The two-layer model.
Yeah, this model proposes that there was an initial ancient wave of hunter-gatherers who arrived in the region maybe 65,000 years ago or even earlier, and they were genetically and culturally distinct from a later wave of Neolithic farmers who arrived much later, bringing agriculture. These smoked burials seem to belong to that older hunter-gatherer layer.
So this practice could be incredibly ancient.
It potentially pushes the origins of mummification, or at least intentional body preservation using drying techniques, way back, possibly even linked to the early expansions of Homo sapiens out of Africa, maybe as far back as 42,000 years ago, though that's more speculative. It's a major revision of our understanding.
Okay, next up, a revelation in the evolution of birds, specifically flightless birds like ostriches and emus. It turns out their ancient ancestors could fly.
That's the finding, yes. Scientists analyzed a really well-preserved fossil of a bird called Lathornis promiscuus. This bird lived around 59 to 56 million years ago, so fairly soon after the asteroid impact that wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs.
And Lathornis is related to today's flightless giants.
Directly. It's considered an ancestor of the modern palaeonath, so that group includes ostriches, emus, kiwis, cassowaries, rheas, basically all the big flightless birds except penguins.
So what did the analysis reveal?
They looked closely at its anatomy, particularly the sternum, the breastbone. In flying birds, the sternum has a large keel where the powerful flight muscles attach. And Lathornis's sternum showed it absolutely supported strong, flapping flight. Probably capable of long-distance travel, maybe comparable to modern birds, like great egrets.
Okay, so this ancestor flew. How does that solve a mystery?
The mystery was how these flightless birds ended up on all these different isolated land masses around the world: Africa, South America, Australia, New Zealand. If their common ancestor couldn't fly, how did they get there after the supercontinent Pangaea had already broken up?
Ah, right. The continents were already separated.
Exactly. This finding shows the ancestor did fly. They flew to these distant land masses after the breakup, and then independently, in each of these different locations, they lost the ability to fly.
They lost flight independently multiple times. Why would they do that? Flight seems like a pretty big advantage.
It is, but it's also incredibly costly in terms of energy. Think about the huge muscles needed, the metabolic demands. The key factor here is timing. The Cretaceous-Paleogene extinction event wiped out almost all the large non-avian predators on land.
So suddenly it was safer on the ground.
Much safer, especially for ground-feeding birds like these ancestors probably were. Without that constant threat from below, the intense selection pressure for flight disappeared. It became more advantageous to save energy, maybe get bigger, focus on running speed. So in different places, they naturally evolved towards flightlessness once the main danger was gone. Of course, mammalian predators eventually evolved in return, but by then, these birds were already committed to their new, large, running lifestyle.
Fascinating. Sticking with dinosaurs for a moment, a new record has been broken for the oldest known dome-headed dinosaur.
That's right. A new species called Zavacephaly rinpoche was discovered in Mongolia, and it dates back 108 to 115 million years ago.
How much older is that than previous records?
About 15 million years older. It helps fill a pretty significant gap we had in the fossil record for these guys, the pachycephalosaurs, or bone-headed dinosaurs.
What was unique about this particular fossil specimen?
It was a juvenile. They could tell by analyzing the growth rings in its lower leg bone, like tree rings. But crucially, even though it was young, it already had a fully developed thick skull dome.
The dome was already there in a juvenile. What does that imply?
Well, pachycephalosaurs are widely believed to have used those thick bony domes for things like headbutting contests, probably for dominance or to attract mates. Finding a fully formed dome on a juvenile suggests that whatever behaviors that dome was for, whether it was display or combat, started early in life for this species. It implies maybe the pressures of sexual selection or establishing social hierarchy were already kicking in before they even reached full adult size.
Interesting glimpse into dinosaur social lives.
Yeah.
Finally, in this section, let's turn to the Maya civilization. There's a controversial new theory proposing that they had a second, previously unknown script based on hand gestures.
Yeah, this is a claim from one anthropologist focusing on the famous altar cue from Copan, Honduras. It's this incredible carved stone block about 1,300 years old, depicting a dynasty of 16 rulers.
And the claim is about their hands.
Exactly. He argues that the specific, distinct hand positions shown for each of the 16 rulers aren't just artistic representations. He claims they actually represent a form of sign language, a previously unrecognized script, and that these signs are linked to specific calendar dates.
Sign language encoding dates. How is that supposed to work?
The theory posits that these hand signs encode numerical values within the Maya long count calendar. That's the complex system the Maya use to track vast stretches of time. Specifically, he thinks the signs represent the Katun, Tun, Wainal, and Kin values.
Okay, break those down quickly.
Sure, the long count is basically base 20. A Kin is one day. A Wainal is 20 days. A Tun is 360 days. Technically 18 Wainals, not 20, to approximate the solar year. And a Katun is 20 tons, so about 20 years.
So the hand signs are meant to be numbers in this system.
That's the claim. For instance, the researcher points out two distinct hand signs used on the altar that he says resemble known hieroglyphic variants for the number zero, which is crucial in the long count.
If this were true, it would mean the Maya writing system was even more complex than we thought, using two scripts, glyphs, and signs.
Yes, potentially utilizing both simultaneously. The anthropologist tried to link the dates he believes are encoded by the hand signs to important historical events in Copan's history, like the death dates of the first and last rulers shown on the altar.
But you said this is controversial.
Highly controversial. We absolutely have to stress that this interpretation is not widely accepted by Mayanists. One prominent expert in Maya archaeology and epigraphy reviewed the claim and called the interpretation very implausible, even suggesting that the data appeared to be manipulated to fit the hypothesis. So this remains a very active, contentious, and currently unverified area of research. An interesting idea, but far from proven.
Okay, let's move into the world of animal survival now, and we have two really remarkable, almost contrasting stories of physical endurance in the wild. First up, a jaguar went for a record-breaking swim.
Yeah, this was in Brazil. A male jaguar was documented swimming up to 1.54 miles, that's nearly 2.5 kilometers straight, across a large reservoir created by the Serra da Mesa Hydroelectric Power Dam.
1.5 miles, that's an incredible distance, even for a jaguar, which we know are good swimmers.
It really surprised the researchers. They noted that while jaguars are definitely adept swimmers and often treat even major rivers in the Amazon like they're no big deal, they usually choose much shorter, less risky crossing points. You know, minimize exposure, save energy.
So why swim so far this time?
They speculate this individual must have been highly motivated. Maybe it was searching for new territory, as the reservoir likely fragmented its original home range. Or perhaps it was tracking the scent of females on the other side. Whatever the reason, it shows an extreme level of determination and physical capability.
Okay, from extreme endurance to an extreme reaction. Over in Florida, we saw a Burmese python do something pretty dramatic because of the cold.
Yes, a large Burmese python was observed vomiting up an entire white-tailed deer it had recently swallowed. This happened right after a cold snap where temperatures dipped to below 50 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 10 Celsius.
Vomiting a whole deer, why?
It confirms something researchers knew happened but had mostly seen in controlled lab settings. It shows that the python's digestion is incredibly temperature sensitive, and this acts as a key limiting factor on how far north this invasive species can successfully spread in the U.S.
How does the cold trigger the vomiting?
Pythons, being reptiles, rely on external heat to maintain their body temperature. Digesting something as large as a deer requires a massive metabolic effort, a huge amount of energy, which in turn requires a high body temperature. When it gets too cold, below about 50 degrees Arif, their metabolism slows right down. Their gut basically shuts down.
So they can't digest the meal.
They can't. And rather than letting that large meal just sit there and potentially rot inside them, which could be fatal, the snake expels it.
Okay, so this is a survival mechanism for the snake in the cold. But it has implications for the python invasion.
It does. On the one hand, vomiting the meal means the snake loses all that critical energy it needs for things like reproduction. So these cold snaps can act as a natural check, slowing down the population's spread northward by reducing reproductive success.
But on the other hand,
On the other hand, the snake survived, and now it's hungry again. It has to hunt and kill another animal soon to regain that energy. So while it might limit range expansion, it doesn't necessarily reduce the immediate impact on local prey populations.
Right. Okay, turning from animal survival to plant survival, there's apparently a race against time happening right now to cryopreserve a critically endangered Australian tree.
Yes, this is the angle-stemmed myrtle, botanical name Gaussia gunaclada, and it is in serious trouble. It's classified as critically endangered.
How many are left?
Only about 380 individual trees are known to exist in the wild, in a small area in southeast Queensland, and they are facing multiple threats.
What's threatening them?
Primarily, a devastating fungal disease called myrtle rust, which affects many plants in the myrtle family. That, combined with the impacts of rising temperatures due to climate change, means its extinction in the wild is considered almost a certainty without significant human intervention.
So scientists are trying to save it?
Yeah.
How? By freezing it?
Essentially, yes. They're using cryopreservation. Hmm. The researchers stated very clearly, this needs to happen fast, because the fungus is literally killing the trees faster than they can propagate them using traditional methods like cuttings.
What exactly are they freezing? Seeds?
Not primarily seeds. Unfortunately, the myrtle rust has also severely reduced the tree's fertility, so viable seeds are rare. And the few seeds they do get have shown exceptionally low survival rates when cryopreserved.
So if not seeds, then what?
They are focusing on cryopreserving the shoot tips. These are the actively growing parts of the plant, the buds. They carefully excise these tips, treat them with special cryoprotective solutions like an antifreeze for plant cells, basically, to prevent damaging ice crystals from forming, and then plunge them into liquid nitrogen.
Liquid nitrogen? That's incredibly cold.
Minus 321 degrees Fahrenheit, or minus 196 Celsius. At that temperature, all biological activity stops, and theoretically, the tissue can be preserved indefinitely.
So the goal is basically to create a frozen genetic backup.
Exactly. The urgency is to capture as much of the remaining genetic diversity from those last 380 or so wild specimens before they're wiped out completely by the rust and climate change. This frozen collection represents the hope for future resurrection, maybe reintroduction attempts if conditions ever become suitable again, or for research. The genetic viability of the entire species really hangs in the balance of how quickly they can collect and freeze these samples.
Wow. Okay, let's shift gears to some everyday science that affects many of us. Persistent bad breath, or halitosis. Brushing alone often doesn't cut it, right?
Yeah.
Why does our breath still stink sometimes?
Yeah, it's a common problem, and the causes are often things we overlook. The simplest one is often just skipping flossing.
Flossing?
Really, absolutely. Food debris trapped between your teeth starts decomposing pretty quickly, releasing foul-smelling gases within just a day or two. Breathing doesn't always get that stuff out.
Okay, so flossing is key, but what if you do floss and brush well and still have issues?
Then the primary biological cause is usually volatile sulfur compounds, or VSCs. These are sulfur-containing gases, think rotten eggs, basically produced by anaerobic bacteria.
Anaerobic, meaning they don't need oxygen.
Right. And they thrive in places where oxygen is low, primarily on the surface of the tongue, especially way at the back where your toothbrush often can't reach effectively. They also love hiding in the little crypts of your tonsils.
So tongue scrapers might help.
They can, yes. Cleaning the tongue is important. But there are other non-hygiene-related factors, too. Dry mouth is a huge contributor.
Why dry mouth?
Because saliva is your mouth's natural detergent. It washes away bacteria and food particles, and it contains compounds that neutralize acids and fight bacteria. If your mouth is dry, maybe due to medications, breathing through your mouth, too much coffee, or even using alcohol-based antiseptic mouthwashes, which can be drying those bacteria run rampant.
Okay. What else?
Gum disease, periodontitis, is another big one. It creates deep pockets between your teeth and gums where bacteria can flourish, producing VSCs. And sometimes persistent bad breath can actually be a sign of an underlying medical issue originating outside the mouth.
Like what?
Things like chronic sinus problems, post-nasal drip, or even gastric reflux can cause odors. And in some cases, it can signal something systemic. For example, unmanaged diabetes can lead to a condition called ketoacidosis, where the body starts burning fat instead of glucose for energy. This produces ketones, which can give the breath a distinct sweet or fruity odor, sometimes described like nail polish remover.
So if bad breath persists despite good hygiene, it's worth checking in with a doctor or dentist.
Definitely. Don't just mask it with mints. Figure out the underlying cause.
Okay, finally in this section, a potentially major breakthrough for electric vehicles. New battery tech out of Korea tackling that persistent problem of charging speed.
Yes, this is about a new lithium metal battery technology. Now, lithium metal batteries have always held the promise of much higher energy density than current lithium ion batteries.
Meaning more range for the same weight.
Exactly. But they've had a major drawback. They degrade very quickly, especially during fast charging, and they can be prone to safety issues.
And that degradation is caused by dendrites.
That's the main culprit, yes. Dendrites are these tiny, needle-like crystalline structures made of lithium metal that tend to grow on the surface of the anode, the negative electrode, during charging, particularly rapid charging.
What do these dendrites do?
They cause all sorts of problems. They consume active lithium, reducing the battery's capacity over time. They can increase internal resistance, making the battery less efficient. And the worst case, they can grow right through the separator membrane and touch the cathode, causing an internal short circuit, which can lead to overheating and potentially fire. This has been the biggest barrier to widespread adoption of lithium metal anodes.
So what did the Korean researchers figure out?
They developed a new type of liquid electrolyte that's the substance that allows ions to flow between the anode and cathode. They call it a cohesion-inhibiting liquid electrolyte.
Cohesion-inhibiting.
Yeah, basically, the chemistry of this electrolyte is specifically designed to suppress the growth of those dendrites. It makes it harder for the lithium atoms to clump together and form those damaging needle-like structures, even during fast charging.
And what was the resulting performance gain? Did it work?
The results they reported are pretty remarkable. Their prototype lithium metal battery could charge from 5% up to 70% capacity in just 12 minutes.
12 minutes to 70%. That's fast.
Very fast. Or they could get to 80% in 17 minutes. And crucially, the battery maintained good performance over 350 charge and discharge cycles, suggesting the dendrite suppression was effective long term.
What does this mean for EVs?
If this technology can be scaled up and commercialized affordably, it could be a game changer. It could allow EVs to charge almost as quickly as filling a gas tank and potentially enable a range of 500 miles or more on a single charge. That combination really addresses the two biggest anxieties consumers still have about EVs: charging time and range anxiety. Big potential impact.
All right, let's quickly turn our eyes to the skies for a look at some celestial events happening right now or very soon. First up, tomorrow, September 21st, is Saturn opposition.
Yes. This is absolutely the best time of the year to view the ring planet. At opposition, Earth passes directly between Saturn and the Sun. So Saturn rises right around sunset, is visible all night long, and is at its closest and brightest for the year.
Where should people look?
Look towards the east after sunset. Saturn will be shining brightly in the constellation Pisces. Even a small telescope will show you the rings. Maybe even its largest moon, Titan.
And you mentioned something called the Seeliger effect.
Ah, yes, the Seeliger effect, sometimes called the opposition surge. If you do have a telescope, pay close attention to the brightness of the rings right around opposition. They might appear dramatically brighter than Saturn's globe itself.
Why is that?
It's because we're viewing the rings with the sun shining directly behind us. This eliminates virtually all the shadows that the billions of tiny ice particles in the rings would normally cast on each other. With no shadows, the collective brightness just surges. It's a cool effect that really only happens right at opposition.
Okay, even sooner, like this morning and tomorrow morning, keep an eye out for a spectacular triple conjunction.
Yeah, this is a really nice one. You'll see the slender crescent moon, dazzlingly bright Venus, and the bright star Regulus, the heart of Leo the lion, all clustered together in the pre-dawn sky.
How close are they?
Incredibly close. They'll appear less than half a degree apart in the sky. For reference, the full moon is about half a degree wide, so they'll look almost like they're touching. It's an ultra-close alignment.
And in some places, the moon might actually pass in front of Venus.
Potentially, yes. Parts of Europe might get to see a lunar occultation of Venus, where the moon briefly hides the planet. Worth checking local astronomy resources for exact timing if you're there.
Okay, looking ahead a bit, if you're planning some deep sky viewing, mark your calendar for a 4-day window in October, October 20th through 23rd.
Yeah, that looks like a potentially fantastic period for sky watchers. There are a couple of reasons. First, we're hoping two comets might become quite bright around then Alkav, then Comet Swan R2 and Comet Lemon, potentially even visible to the naked eye under dark skies.
Comets are always unpredictable, but promising.
Always unpredictable, but definitely worth looking for. And the best part is, this period coincides perfectly with the new moon.
Meaning dark skies.
the darkest possible skies, which is ideal for spotting faint comets or meteors. And speaking of meteors, that window also includes the peak of the Orionid meteor shower.
The Orionids. Those come from Halley's Comet debris, right?
That's right. You can typically expect about 20 shooting stars per hour radiating from the constellation Orion during the peak, and the dark new moon skies will make them much easier to see this year. So comets and meteors could be a great weekend.
And one quick note on planetary defense before we move on. That skyscraper-sized asteroid, 2025 FA22, zipped past us safely on September 18th.
Yes, harmless flyby. Its collision risk was quickly ruled out weeks ago. But it wasn't just ignored. This was actually a valuable live training exercise for the global planetary defense community.
How so?
The International Asteroid Warning Network, or IAWN, used this close approach to practice their emergency protocols, as if it were a potential threat. They coordinated observations from telescopes worldwide to precisely measure the asteroid's characteristics, its size, shape, rotation speed, composition, mass.
Why gather all that data if it wasn't going to hit us?
To refine their models and procedures. All that information is exactly what they would need to plan a potential deflection mission if a truly dangerous asteroid were ever detected on a collision course. So every close flyby like this is a chance to practice and improve our readiness.
Okay, good to know they're practicing. Now for a quick roundup of some interesting tech, gear, and history quick hits. Starting with a design innovation tackling a very modern problem. The computer mouse redesign aimed at reducing repetitive strain injury, or RSI.
Yeah, this is about wrist pain from using a mouse all day. Researchers developed two pretty radical new mouse prototypes to try and combat this. One had a sort of squeezable mesh body, and the other had a hinged A-frame design.
How were they supposed to reduce RSI? Better ergonomic.
Not just ergonomics in the traditional sense of hand shape. The key innovation was trying to reduce the small, constant repositioning movements of the wrist itself. Those tiny adjustments you make over and over again are a major contributor to long-term pain and injury.
How did the designs reduce those movements?
Well, the squeezable mesh mouse allowed users to manipulate the cursor by subtly flexing their grip, kind of squeezing different parts of the mesh, rather than sliding the whole mouse around as much. The hinged A-frame design changed the angle and reduced how much you had to extend your fingers horizontally.
Do they work?
According to the study, both prototypes did significantly reduce those problematic wrist repositioning movements compared to a standard mouse. Interestingly, though, user feedback was mixed. People often complain they missed familiar features like a standard scroll wheel, even if the new designs were potentially better for their wrists long term. Old habits die hard.
Indeed. Okay, shifting to photography gear. There's a highly recommended lens review out for the Viltrox AF 16mm f1.8 FE.
Yes, this sounds like a winner, especially for certain types of photographers. It's a professional grade, full frame, ultra wide angle prime lens designed for Sony E-mount and Nikon Z-mount mirrorless cameras.
And it's particularly good for...
It's getting rave reviews specifically for astrophotography and landscape work. The key is that it maintains exceptional sharpness right across the frame, even when shooting wide open at its very fast f1.8 aperture.
Which is great for low light, like stars.
Exactly. For astrophotographers, it reportedly shows impressively low coma. That's where stars near the edge of the frame look like little seagulls instead of points, and also minimal chromatic aberration or color fringing. Basically, it delivers professional-level image quality for Astro, rivaling lenses that cost maybe three times as much, and the price point is apparently a bargain, around $464 US.
Sounds like a good deal for Sony and Nikon shooters doing landscapes or Astro. Next, for fitness folks, the Sun to Run watch got reviewed. How does it stack up?
It's being positioned as a strong competitor in that crowded fitness tracker market, particularly as an affordable alternative to some of the higher-end Garmin models.
What are its strengths?
It's praised for being feature-packed for its price point. It offers things like offline music storage, so you can leave your phone at home, and detailed on-watch navigation with maps. Its GPS tracking for outdoor running is reported to be highly accurate as well.
Any drawbacks?
The main one highlighted in the review is still heart rate accuracy, particularly during certain types of exercise. While it might be fine for steady-state running, the reviewer found its optical heart rate sensor struggled significantly during high-intensity, weights-based gym sessions. Those rapid changes in wrist position and muscle tension seem to throw off the readings, which is a common issue for wrist-based optical sensors, but something potential buyers should be aware of.
Good to know. Okay, quick history hits. A Noval 1900-year-old melted treasure hoard found in Romania.
Yeah, this sounds like a really evocative find. It's a collection of Roman-era metal items, coins, jewelry, silver ornaments discovered in the scorched ruins of what was likely an elite family's house. This was in the Roman province of Dacia, which is modern-day Romania, dating back to the Principate period, roughly the 2nd or 3rd century AD.
And it was melted.
Right. The house clearly burned down, and the intense heat melted the metal objects, probably silver and bronze, causing them to fuse together inside whatever container they were stored in, maybe a wooden box or casket. What's fascinating is that the melted blob actually preserved the internal shape of that container, which has long since decayed. It's this very direct, almost tragic snapshot of wealth and destruction during that period.
Wow. And finally, new context provided for the Pawnee Star Chart.
Yes. This refers to a famous artifact, an elk skin map or chart painted with celestial symbols, which was used by Pawnee priests in North America primarily for recounting a foundational origin story.
Was there debate about what it represented?
There has been some debate among researchers whether it was intended as a literal functional map of the heavens used for precise astronomical observation, or if it was more purely symbolic and narrative.
And the latest analysis suggests...
The latest analysis confirms that it definitely depicts recognizable, accurate patterns of stars visible in the night sky over the plains. And it strongly suggests that the Pawnee did use these celestial patterns to track seasonal shifts. They recognized how the positions of certain stars or constellations correlated with times for planting, harvesting, ceremonies, and other important events. So while it served a vital narrative and religious purpose, it was also grounded in careful observation of the cosmos, using the sky as a calendar. #... outro stalking.
Well, we have certainly processed a monumental volume of material today. We've connected the absolute vastness of cosmic cartography, you know, using FRBs to map invisible matter, measuring the recoil speed of a baby black hole, right down to the microscopic urgency of placental health under assault from air pollution.
Yeah, and navigating the ethical quandaries posed by potentially sentient human-like tissue grown in a lab, it's really spanned the gamut.
We've seen the sheer complexity of both nature and policy, from the controversial reconstitution of the ACIP committee and the downstream effects on the childhood vaccine schedule.
All the way back to the necessity of finding new niobium deposits. Resources formed when the Rodinia supercontinent ripped itself apart 830 million years ago.
It really is that dramatic contrast between timescales that feels particularly compelling this week. On one hand, we have this urgent race against the clock to cryopreserve that critically endangered tree, the angle-stemmed myrtle.
Right, trying to save it before it goes extinct due to very current threats like climate change and fungal disease, a crisis unfolding over just decades or even years.
And yet, on the other hand, we discussed how the very framework of our solar system, the architecture that dictates Pluto's strange but stable long-term existence, is determined by these incredibly complex gravitational resonances established over hundreds of millions, even billions of years.
Yeah, science is delivering both that sense of instantaneous urgency act now and this perspective of immense deep-time stability that requires patient observation just to comprehend.
So here's a final thought for you, our listener, to maybe mull over. Consider this contrast. In which context do you find the truest measure of scientific impact? Is it in the urgent microcrisis, like saving the myrtle, demanding immediate action to prevent the loss of a single species right now?
Or is it in the vast, deep-time discoveries, like understanding Pluto's orbit, which refine our fundamental models of existence but operate on timescales far beyond human experience? Where does the real impact lie in the race to save the immediate future, or in the discovery that redefines our entire past?
A profound thought indeed to end on. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive into the latest in life science.
Until next time.